explorers, welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooke Sagney. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of the Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. Earth explorers, welcome, welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. We're glad you're here with us tonight, and we're coming to you live from Eastern Washington State, up against the Canadian border. It's a little chilly tonight, about 40 degrees, and rainy, but I have good news. The biodiesel plant is up and running, yes indeed. The solar wind tonight is 460 kilometers per second. Proton count is a mere 2.2. There was a high latitude sunspot, but solar scientists called it 2007, or 1007, and it did fade out before showing any activity. So far, solar cycle number 24 is a no-show. There actually is no space news to report tonight. The elections have drained all the oxygen out of the news agencies this week. Have hope, my friends. There is a good feeling in the wind. Those of you familiar with the international bestseller, The Orion Mystery, will have no trouble knowing who our guest is tonight. The revelation that the Egyptian pyramids were meticulously designed to align with the Orion star system shook the very foundations of archaeology. It was a huge shock as modern Egyptologists were dumbfounded by our guest's hypothesis. Well, the Egypt Code further develops this amazing correlation and reveals a grand unified plan that involves nearly all the temples in Egypt. Get ready to be enlightened as to why the pyramids were built how important they are today for the legacy of mankind. Please welcome my guest, Robert Balval. How are you, Robert?
I'm fine, Brooke. I'm ready to go, so shoot.
All right. Well, you know, only a few of our listeners have probably been to Egypt. I think more than a few have watched the cable channels and know that the pyramids are a great mystery. So, first of all, can you explain all the precision with which the pyramids were built?
When we say pyramids in Egypt, most people think of the those famous three pyramids at Giza.
Right.
In fact, although they're the greatest, and one of them is the last surviving wonder of the ancient world, the Great Pyramid of King Cheops, there are in fact 25 so-called Great Pyramids in the region of modern Cairo, on the west side of the Nile near Cairo. They belong to a period called the Old Kingdom. A tag that Egyptologists put on the chronology of ancient Egypt. So we're talking about a period roughly between 2800 BC to about 2200 BC. So there's approximately 500 to 600 years of pyramid construction in that part of the world. In fact, that's where it all began, this kind of curious pyramid frenzy. We call this the Pyramid Age. Now, I'll be focusing tonight on the Giza Pyramid, the famous three. And although, like you introduced, I'll be dealing towards the latter part of our interview on what I call the Egypt Code, which is incorporating not just the pyramids of Egypt, but the whole legacy that the ancient Egyptian left us. For those of your listeners, I was going to say readers, but listeners who are unfamiliar with the background, the historical background. So like I said, we're talking about the period between 2800 BC to about 2200 BC, that is 500 to 600 years of the so-called Pyramid Age. During that period, the Egyptians focused all their energies in raising those great pyramids in the northern part of Egypt. Later on, they developed, the expression of their ideologies changed into temple buildings. And we have the Temple Age, which lasted till the Christian era. So there is roughly 3,000 years of Egyptian civilization, which is very much visible today if you come to Egypt, because much of this legacy of temples and pyramids are still very much there for us to see. These monuments. Hello?
Well, I was just going to say, you know, a lot of people are aware of the pyramids, but not really aware of how they were built. I mean, they may have seen a few Discovery Channel specials, but how many blocks are actually in the Great Pyramid in Giza?
Right. Well, there's two things that one has to consider about these monuments. And one of them is, of course, how were they built? And I'll get into that in a minute. But the most intriguing, really, is why were they built? And that's where I come in. But coming to the great pyramids of Giza, and particularly the great pyramid of King Cheops, or Khufu, as the Egyptologists call him, this is a monument that is... Well, let me give you some statistics. It's about 146 meters high. It's got a base perimeter of about a kilometer. So it's like a massive square on the ground, raises itself on a slope to a height of 146 meters. Each side of this Great Pyramid is about a quarter of a kilometer long, 230 meters long. And it has a mass, a weight, if you like, if you could put it on a scale, of about 6 million tons. To give you an idea of what we're talking about, in comparison, the Empire State Building, if one could weigh it, would be approximately 500,000 tons of material. We're talking here about 6 million tons. So it's an enormous construction. But what we're thinking about...
Where were the rocks quarried to build it?
Okay, the old pyramids, but let's focus on the Great Pyramid. The core blocks, what we call the masonry blocks that form the core of the pyramid, there's about 2.5 million of them, by the way, ranging between 2 and 15 tons, came from the local region. So the Great Pyramid is built on what we call a plateau, a sort of high raised mound on the west side of the Nile, and it's from this area that came the blocks from the core. Now the pyramid was cased or covered with a very smooth casing of stones. Now these came from the other side of the Nile. They're a higher quality of rock or limestone, generally limestone. But what is stunning about this monument is the interior of the monument, and especially the king's chamber, which is built of granite, black granite stone. Now, this particular stone does not exist in the area where the pyramid stands. It had to be brought from approximately 1,000 kilometers south of Egypt in the upper parts of the Nile. And these blocks, which are forming this so-called King's Chamber, are at an altitude of about 50 meters above the ground, and some of these blocks weigh over 70 tons. So this is the real mystery of the construction of the pyramid, is not so much how they built the whole core, which in itself is a stunning feat, but the chamber itself, which has these enormous size blocks. I mean, 70 tons is the weight of about 2 locomotives, if you like. So that's what it's composed of. But having said this, what is even more intriguing is the precision of the construction.
Right.
It isn't just a pyramid. I call it a high-tech pyramid. It's the kind of Swiss watch accuracy construction. And when modern researchers started analyzing this monument, they very quickly realized that it's perfectly aligned. The base of the pyramid, each side of the base, which is a square base, is perfectly aligned to the cardinal directions, the astronomical directions, to a precision that is within 5% of one single degree. And in construction, I can tell you, this is kind of bullseye construction, very, very precise. So it isn't just building a pyramid, which in itself is a difficult task. It's building a pyramid with this kind of precision that is intriguing. It's the difference between a cheap made in Taiwan watch and a Rolex watch, if you see what I mean.
Sure. So now here's one of the confusing things that a lot of at least Westerners get wrong. How long ago were these pyramids built? You know, which one was first? Was the Great Pyramid at Giza first, or was Saqqara first? What's the real story there?
Well, there's two stories, really. There is what we call the conventional story, and then there is the alternative story, which is where I come in as well.
Okay.
Let me just give you the conventional, or what we call the orthodox version.
Okay.
First of all, what has to be said about the pyramids is that, and particularly the Great Pyramids of Giza, is that they raise 4 questions. We really don't know precisely when they were built. We don't know who built them exactly. We don't know when they were built. And more intriguingly, we didn't know why they were built. So they're huge question marks that stick out of the desert like icebergs, provoking the mind. I mean, for newcomers, if you're a first-time visitor to Egypt and you're confronted with these monuments, they are bound to not just awe you and shock you with their size and their precision, but they raise these enormous questions. You know, what are they doing here? You know, and who put them there?
Exactly.
But let me give you the... Hello?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the chronology as it stands in conventional circles is that the very first pyramid that was built not just in Egypt but in the world is the Saqqara pyramid, the so-called step pyramid, and this is conventionally dated to about 2006 to 2700 BC. And that's when Egyptologists say that the pyramid age began. What's amazing about this particular pyramid is that it seems to have come from literally nowhere. I mean, before that, the Egyptians, although built certain things, they built them in a very rough mud bricks. It seems like some sort of import of technology just suddenly appeared in the country. Because this pyramid is not... Well, in fact, it's not really a pyramid. It's a step pyramid. It's got 6 tiers. It's a bit like a wedding cake, going to a height of about 60 meters. What's stunning about this particular pyramid is the complex around it, which is an architectural complex with stunning architectural features like arches and fluted columns and amazing details, which is kind of bizarre when you're told that this is the very, very first architectural monument where they used the quarried and hewn stone. It really doesn't blend with what you're told. It's as if not just architecture, but the whole knowledge of design just suddenly was born in the mind of an individual, and this complex was constructed. Following this Saqqara pyramid comes the so-called true pyramid construction, with two massive pyramids built a little bit south of this site. Now, this Saqqara site is about 15 kilometers south of Cairo. A further 10 kilometers, and you actually see them from Saqqara, two enormous pyramids built in a region we call Dashur. And these are true pyramids in the sense that they are cased with a smooth stone, giving the appearance of a smooth-shaped pyramid. These are the very first true pyramids. And they're built by the father of Cheops. But as if this wasn't enough, the son of this particular pharaoh who raised these great pyramids at Dashur is Cheops, who raised the famous Great Pyramid. And then followed a series of other pyramids, which lasted for about 200 years, totaling about 25. So this is what you're looking at. And incidentally, most of these pyramids are standing still in Egypt. So we're, in a sense, very lucky to have this legacy after 5,000 years as the conventional dating stands.
Sure.
But there's many of us, including myself, who believe that we're looking at perhaps a much, much older phase, a much, much older culture. And I'll get into that as we progress in this interview. So,
yeah, I'm with you on that. I went to Mexico and looked at Teotihuacan, and this was a city that had some pyramid-like structures, of course, much younger than the ones in Egypt and built differently. But the idea was that, or at least the realization was, that the Mayans didn't build it. They sort of walked up on it, and it was just sitting there, and they adopted it. And many people believe that that might be just what the Egyptians did, that somebody built these things a long time ago, and the Egyptians inherited them.
Well, okay. First of all, you didn't ask me what am I doing in Dubai, in the Gulf, the Arabian Gulf, which is very relevant to what you just about said. I'm here to introduce a major conference, one of the very first ever that's been given in this part of the world, on these ancient mysteries. And it's happening in about 3 weeks' time, at the end of this month. And many of the top researchers in this field, we've got Robert Schock, who is the man who, the professor at Boston University, the geologist, who raised the huge controversy about the age of the Sphinx, which we'll talk, I hope, as well in this interview.
Oh, yeah, that's
and,
right.
And various other researchers like Michael Cremo of Forbidden Archaeology, myself. We've got Thomas Brophy, a newcomer in this field, an astrophysicist, who is going to be writing a book with me, which will deal precisely with the points that you've raised, is that there has emerged recently very, very strong evidence in the western deserts of Egypt, what we call the Egyptian Sahara, that beyond any doubt has demonstrated that there has been a much older civilization in this part of the world, perhaps the oldest, which provided the very fiber of what we call civilization. We've just come from an expedition, by the way, which we undertook in April this year, in the depths of the Egyptian Sahara, way, way in the southwest. And I hope we'll have time to talk about this, because this is really the big new thing, is that suddenly all these theories about a much older phase in civilization, and particularly in Egypt, are no more theories. We're finding hard evidence of the presence of a culture there that that was much, much older than the pharaonic culture. So we'll deal with that as we go along. So having said this, yes, there are people, including myself, who are very, very convinced that we're looking at monuments, or rather that the academics are looking at these monuments in very much the wrong way. That they, two things. One is that they could either themselves be older, we're looking at a much older structure, or that they are the product of a much older culture, a culture that we haven't yet properly identified. And also, that their function is very, very different from the tomb function that has been allocated to these monuments, that they represent something else entirely. So there are two schools, if you like, that have been debating over the years, and the intensity of this debate is building up.
Excuse me? No, go ahead. I want you to finish your thought.
Yeah, well, I'm getting an echo, so sometimes I think you're talking. Okay, well, the conventional school of thought is that these monuments are tombs, admittedly very large tombs, but nonetheless tombs, to put the body of a pharaoh, and they were built roughly around 2500 BC by a very low-tech society that just used brutal force to raise those stones. So this is the conventional view. The alternative view is that we're looking at a far more sophisticated culture with a much higher level of technology that is much older, or that it inherited a much older knowledge. So this is the debate, if you like, and mainly it was debated on levels of theories. I came in with a theory in 1994 about the Orion correlation theory, which I'll talk about as well. But essentially this is the debate, and what's coming out now in the last 5-6 years is that it's no more theory. We're getting hard evidence. There is hard evidence of a much older phase and a much more sophisticated phase in the region. So that's where it stands today. This is the cutting edge. Now what we need is another little push, a kind of surge, if you like, using the jargon of today, to provide much harder evidence to close this debate once and for all, because really I think it's extremely important for the very reason that, like my co-author Graham Hancock often says, we're a species with amnesia. We really don't know who we are and where we came from, and we're like orphans, if you like. And closing this debate properly to really understand our origins is very, very important, because without knowing where we came from, we certainly don't know where we're going.
Well, Robert, you're in the right place, because we wonder about these things all the time. So let's get right to it. You know, at the base of Saqqara, there is a small structure that looks a little like a stone telephone booth with a statue inside. Now, the statue appears to be looking out a small round window towards something. And you made a remarkable discovery about this. Can you explain that?
Indeed. But let me give you the background, because if I sort of spurt out the explanation, it may not make much sense to your listeners. Let me tell you what spurred the whole pyramid construction in Egypt. I mean, what was the impetus? What was the belief? And let me tell you from the outset that what comes out of analyzing these monuments and the related texts and their architecture and the alignments that they have is that the ancients who built these structures believed, or maybe even had, I mean, this is the intriguing question, that they had found a science, what I've coined the science of immortality, that they truly believed that they could transfigure a physical body of their king into a spiritual entity, a sort of entity that would live among the stars, would return to the stars. Now, whether you believe it or not is another matter, but they emphatically believe this, and that's what is intriguing about this culture, is that they so much believed what they could do, that they went ahead and built those massive structures. So the pyramids, in a sense, are part of the hardware of a science. They are the machine, if you like, to transfigure the body of a king or the body of individuals into spiritual entities.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, first of all, why did they develop this belief, and how do they hope to do it? So that's what one needs to understand before we tackle the meaning of this monument.
Well, do you think maybe that they had seen it done already, or that they had been shown a model of this before, and they tried to copy it?
Yes, but not in the way that perhaps you're thinking.
Okay.
Let me just explain. First of all, one needs to understand the context. Egypt itself. Now, Egypt is basically it's a desert, and the reason it's inhabited even today is because this desert is bisected by a river. Without this river, the whole land is a desert. So if you can imagine Egypt, if you're flying over, which we can do these days with Google Earth, you're looking at an area roughly ranging from the Mediterranean Sea in the north all the way to the Sudanese borders in the south, which is about a thousand kilometers long, of a river valley on which both sides, in the east and west, is desert. So really, what makes Egypt is this river. And what's intriguing about this river, even today, and certainly in the times of the ancient Egyptians, is that first of all, and until the 19th century, by the way, we had no idea where its source was. We had no idea where the water came from. This was in itself a great mystery to the ancients, the origins, the source of this river. And even more mysteriously, this river would flood once a year, the waters of the Nile would rise, and this would happen in the height of summer, which made it even more intriguing, because Egypt normally is a very dry kind of country. It doesn't rain much there. And you'd expect a river to rise, if it rises at all in this kind of dry climate, at least in the rainy season. Whereas what happened is that the water would rise in the dry season, and this created an enormous mystery in the minds of the ancients. But it was also a fear, because this flooding of the Nile, this flooding of the land, was a kind of automatic hydraulic system that irrigated the land and fertilized the soil, and literally gave life to Egypt. So without this flood, Egypt would simply not survive. And therefore the fear that this flood would not happen and the desire to understand and control this flood was certainly in the minds of the very ancients who lived in this land. And by virtue of being forced to kind of look for an explanation, they began to look at the sky, because what intrigued them was that the flood would occur, like I said, in the summertime, in the period of what today we call the summer solstice, when the sun is at its apogee, when it rises in the extreme north on the eastern horizon and culminates at noon at its highest point. And they began to see some sort of correlation, that somehow the position of the sun in this maximum position in the sky was somehow causing the river to flood. And they began to think, sort of as above, so below, the famous dictum that is very much cited in the New Age these days. They began to see some sort of mechanism that was somehow regulated in the sky by the gods or whatever they imagined up there, to cause this mechanism on the ground, this hydraulic machine, this cycles of the Nile to occur. But what really intrigued them was that on that particular time of year, around the summer solstice, there was a group of stars that would rise at dawn just before sunrise. Now, having said this, I need to sort of... You're still there, by the way, Brooks?
Oh, yeah, still here, still listening.
Okay, just give me a cue, because sometimes the line cuts off, and I carry on speaking to a phone.
Okay. All right.
The intriguing thing to them was that they began to observe this particular group of stars, and let me say from the outset that these stars were the constellation of Orion, the famous constellation that one sees in this time of the year, by the way, very brightly in the sky. At this moment, as I'm talking to you, they should be in the west, in my part of the world at this time. This group of stars, which are particularly bright, are followed by an extremely bright star, the brightest star in the sky, that we call Sirius, the star Sirius.
Right.
And what's intriguing about these stars, or any stars that you watch in its cycle, is that they seem to disappear for about 70 days in their yearly cycle. I'm not going to go into the mechanics and science of this, but if you would observe a group of stars through the year, you would notice that there would be a time when the stars would appear just after sunset in the west, when the sun sets. So as the sky darkens, you see those group of stars for a few seconds, and then they set below the horizon. And should you come a day later, the particular star that you're looking at would not be in the sky anymore. They would have already set. They seem to be sort of going underground, if you like. And for 70 days, they simply wouldn't be in the sky. But in a kind of strange, miraculous way in the minds of the Egyptians, these stars would reappear 70 days later, this time in the east, just before dawn. They appear to be reborn, if you like, as if some sort of magical event took place under the earth as the stars went down in the west, and 70 days later they reappeared, they're reborn in the east at dawn. So this kind of rebirth of the stars, which coincided with the rebirth of the Nile, began to form a kind of belief system in the minds of the ancient Egyptians. It's as if they could themselves become stars, if they could join the stars that perform this rebirth activity, then they themselves could be reborn. So this is where the idea comes from. Strangely enough, I think this is where it comes intriguing, is that they weren't far wrong. It's as if they intuitively guessed or found out what today astrophysicists would tell you is quite true, is that we do have our origins in the stars. I mean, this is an astrophysical fact. Everything that is on this planet comes from the stars, or a star, and we don't know which, but we're star stuff become conscious, if you like. We're star matter that has become conscious. But we know it, or at least we're approaching that knowledge, through what we call science, a kind of external way of trying to understand the world. Whereas they seem to have developed, and this is what is very intriguing about these ancient people, and this is what intrigues me particularly, is that they seem to have used another faculty that we possess and we've stopped using. What I call the introvert search, the search inside. I believe that we contain inside us the knowledge of everything, and that we can retrieve this knowledge if we can again discover how the ancients did it, a sort of search in the inside. So I keep saying to a lot of people that the truth isn't out there, it's in here, if you like. The only
right.
thing is we've lost the ability to touch it, to retrieve it. I was having a very interesting conversation yesterday with one of our organizers here, a lady. Because what's stunning to me, for example, is if you take the female gender of creatures, of human life, is that they actually can create life. I mean, we tend to forget this. They have the knowledge to make a human being, and yet they can't explain it. So the knowledge is in there, and really, if there was a way to retrieve it, and I believe that the ancients managed to do this. They focus on their internal knowledge, simply because they didn't have the science and technology that we have today. So this is why it's so important to understand these ancients, not just because they left these legacies of monuments and pyramids, it's because they perhaps managed to develop a science that we not only do not apply and forgot, but we don't even believe in it. But this is the intriguing thing about this culture. Hello, Brooke.
Yes, you know, one of the fascinating things is as you're painting this story for us about how important the star Sirius was and the complex of the Orion stars were. Every time I talk to people who have been to Egypt, they say, oh, yes, yes, we saw the pyramids, and they're all lined up north, south, east, west, right to the cardinal points. But that really isn't the case, is it? They're more accurately aimed very precisely at one stellar body. Is that right?
Yes. Now, let me get into this. But let me give you the bottom line of this. The Egyptians, in so many words, if one studies the text in relation to the monuments that these texts were written. Now, when I'm speaking of these texts, by the way, I'm speaking of the so-called pyramid texts.
Right, the pyramid texts.
One of the intriguing things... Yeah, sorry?
I said, hello? Yes, the pyramid texts.
Yes, let me explain to you what the pyramid texts are. The intriguing thing as well, if it wasn't enough of what I've just been saying about the Great Pyramids of Giza, is that they do not contain any inscriptions. The people who built them left them totally uninscribed, which in itself is a mystery, because one would have thought that if they were these egomaniacal pharaohs that were told by the academics, then one would expect them at least to put their names on it.
Well, every other building they built in Egypt is covered with writing and pictures, except those.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And even more intriguing is that the pyramids of the dynasty that follows, the so-called fifth dynasty and sixth dynasty, are full of text, in contrast to the bare great pyramids of Giza. And clearly there is a link between the two. So these are the famous pyramid texts. And when you look and read those texts and understand, or at least attempt to understand them, you realize very quickly that they're speaking of what we can loosely call a sky religion. Basically, they speak of the sky. I mean, they speak of the resurrection of the pharaoh. And essentially what they say, in a nutshell, is that we come from the stars, and when we die, we return to the stars. I mean, that's the message. And whether we take this seriously or not, is the big controversy that is raging in this field. Of course, the academics are saying, well, this is just a bunch of superstitious ideas, and it's nice to know what we're doing, but it's a lot of hocus-pocus. But it's quite possible that they understood their origin. I mean, we know now today, it's a fact, that we come from the stars. I mean, we're somewhere out there in the cosmos was a star where all that we see around us on this planet originated. We know this. What we don't know, and the Egyptians seem to know, is what we're supposed to do here. I mean, okay, we came from the stars, but what do we do? You know, what's the mission? And more intriguingly is, where do we go afterwards? I mean, what happens to us once our heart stops beating? And the Egyptians seem to have understood what happened. And this alone is very intriguing and very worth pursuing, because they were very, very convinced that they would return to these stars. And not just any star. That they would return to this particular star that you mentioned. That they would return to this group of stars where Orion and Sirius are in the sky.
And well, when you say that we originate in the stars, and a lot of people think about that, and they think, well, maybe we came on a frozen asteroid and we landed in the ocean and all life came from that. And then again, maybe we came in a ship, a sort of arc of millions of years to this planet, and we just forgot how we got here.
Well, first of all, I think that since we're getting into that kind of discussion, one has to set the scene here. You know, we're looking at a universe that, as far as we know today, is at least 20 billion years old. And since in the last month we'll be talking about billions of things, you know, bailing out banks with billions. I think a lot of people know when I say a billion is 1,000 million. Now, that's a billion. So this universe has existed here for 20 billion years, or 20,000 years, right? I mean, it's an enormous time. And yet, our planet is only here for 4 billion years. So there's been something like 16 to 15,000 billion years where this universe has existed, and we haven't the faintest idea what happened. We haven't the faintest idea what happened 10,000 years ago, let alone billions of years ago.
Right.
I'm very open to the idea of, I mean, really, if we were told, I mean, I'm one of these people who say, if we were told the truth about this universe, it would be even more mysterious than the most outrageous theory that is being proposed. We live in a very, very, very mysterious universe that we haven't even begun to understand. So I think those who are being skeptical about the possibility of intelligent life and life existing beyond our planet really is not on anymore. Now, how and where and when and whether this our planet was visited I cannot tell you. I mean, the truth is that nobody knows, no matter how many theories are presented. But the possibility is there. And indeed, not just the possibility, but the great possibility, it's a kind of, today, what was regarded as taboo and outrageous, it's become common discussion among astrophysicists. Nobody would deny that the great possibility of intelligence outside our planet exists. I mean, we're discovering planets every day now. 20 years ago, scientists would deny that there could be other planets in the universe, let alone in our own galaxy, because they had no proof. Now proof is coming, so suddenly the whole scene is changing. So who is to tell, I mean, really, who is to tell that somehow some other great civilization out there somehow found its way here? I mean, although the evidence has not been forthcoming, you know the old saying, the absence of evidence isn't proof that something didn't exist. And maybe one day we will be stunned that what we thought was an ancient culture perhaps is a much more sophisticated culture, that perhaps, and I'm putting this big perhaps, but nonetheless it is a perhaps, that it had some sort of means or recollection, if you want to look at it, some sort of memory of its origin. We are the ones who forgot. Maybe the Egyptians did remember and did know. And I'd like to get into that part of the discussion towards the end of this interview, because I want to talk about the evidence that we found in the Sahara.
Yeah, I definitely want to cover that, and we'll do that maybe toward the end of the second hour and into the third hour. But one of the things that strikes me and just amazes me is that you have discovered that these pyramids, and not just three, but many pyramids, are built in Egypt in a certain pattern, in a certain arrangement, so that they match a stellar constellation so perfectly that they almost sit there in the middle of the mass of the earth as a beacon, not to people on the ground, but to people in the sky, that either the Egyptians or those that were there before the Egyptians remember where they came from, and maybe they want those that come from that area to recognize the map on the ground and return.
Okay. Now, you obviously know a lot about this. My second book was written with the author Graham Hancock. You know Graham Hancock, I presume.
Yes, oh yes.
The Lost Civilization Man. We wrote a book which in the States was called Message of the Sphinx. Because after years and years of being exposed to these monuments and studying the texts and studying their alignments and pondering over them, and what was coming out from our research was that we began to feel that what was there for us to analyze and understand was a message. The bottom line of this message, and I will explain how we arrived at it, is we come from the stars, we come from these particular stars, and we're going to go back to the stars, and we'll give you a date when all this started. And the date is 10,500 BC. I mean, that's what comes out if you would start from basics and analyze the alignment of these monuments at Giza. Now, it's not hocus pocus. We applied astronomical science, because essentially what you're looking at is pyramids that are astronomically aligned, so clearly, and of course the text which emphasized this celestial link and this destiny of the kings in the stars. So clearly, astronomy is a tool to understand these monuments. Indeed, it's a tool to read those monuments. And that's probably why they do not contain text, is that they speak a language that is, for better words, a universal language of mathematics and astronomy. That's what appears to be the case there. Because you're looking at geometry there, you're looking at intriguing design. For example, since we were talking about the Great Pyramid, one of the things that is now being recognized by the academics, of which researchers have known for the last century, is that the pyramid is designed in such a way, the Great Pyramid, that the base of the pyramid, in relation to its height, is the same as the circumference of a circle in relation to its radius. In other words, that the pyramid represents a circle. And that's very, very intriguing, because it contains what we call in mathematics the value pi, this secret magical number that allows you to calculate the volume and areas of circles and curves, and is essential to understand the universe. It's essential to understand if you're going to space travel. You need to know that figure. So it's there. It's actually there inside the mathematics of the monument. So that's intriguing. It's really intriguing that this monument that sticks out as a sore thumb for us to understand contains this universal constant in its design. And as if this wasn't enough, it is locked to the astronomical machinery of the sky above. It is aligned to high precision, and inside the monument there are these two chambers, which we call the King and Queen's Chamber, and these have what Egyptologists call shafts. They're kind of strange narrow tunnels that shoot out through the core of the monument from the chamber and point to the stars, and those very stars of Orion and Sirius that they keep talking about. So that's what you have on the ground. And we began to coin the phrase, the language of these people, which is not alphabetic language. We began to use the word astroglyphics rather than hieroglyphics. Hieroglyphics means the alphabet or language of signs. This is what you were talking about earlier, that the monuments of Egypt are full of these writings. In fact, it's a sign language. They use a sign language. They have images of birds and animals and things. Whereas the pyramids express themselves in the language of science, a language of mathematics and astronomy, which the best way to call it is astroglyphics. They speak of a sort of star language. And this is where we began to approach this study, by trying to understand what they were saying. And like I said, finally what seems out of this analysis, because of the way it's aligned and the stars that they point, because I came up with, in the early 80s, with the so-called Orion correlation theory, is that the monuments on the ground, the three pyramids on the ground, which are two large, massive structures, two large pyramids of almost equal size, you don't need to be a brain surgeon to realize that these two structures are aligned relative to each other along a diagonal. If you would look at the overhead picture, it's very obvious. And yet, the third pyramid that is there is much smaller, and it's offset to the left of this alignment. And amazingly, nobody sort of said why. You know, it's one of those strange things. And I'm the first person to have said, well, why is that? I mean, we're looking at the plan. What does it mean? And as you begin to discover the connections that these people had with these particular stars of Orion, you suddenly realize that at the center of Orion are three bright stars that are aligned in exactly the same way that these pyramids are aligned on the ground. And even more intriguing, that the stars are in a position relative to the Milky Way, which appears to be a sort of river in the sky, in exactly the same way that the pyramids are aligned relative to the Nile. So you've got a kind of, as above, so below map. You have a map of the pyramids in the sky. It's as if they're giving us a map. It's as if there's a map drawn on the ground that says, look up there, you know, and that's where we come from.
Here we are.
I believe it's another matter, but that's what it says.
Well, you know, it's interesting that for a long, long time, people thought that the Egyptians were sun worshippers, hence Ra and Heliopolis and all the things that have to do with the sun. But what you pointed out is that the structures, the main structures that took literally hundreds of millions of man-hours to build, if they say that they built them, are not aligned to the sun at all, but to these stars. And the calendar system that they used did not line up with the sun or the earth, revolving around the sun, or at least a 24-hour day. It had to do with a completely different calendar that sort of floated, frustrating other civilizations around the world. How did that calendar, that Egyptian calendar, set up to accommodate this rising, setting, and return of Sirius?
I'm very proud of you, Brooke. You obviously read my book in detail. Okay, good question. Okay, here we go. And I need to make this as simple as possible because it's not so easy without images. But if you were to observe the stars, and let's take Sirius as the reference point, the reason the Egyptians focused on the star, we said earlier, is because it would make its reappearance, it would make its rebirth at the beginning of the Nile flood season. In the minds of the Egyptian, it was this star that triggered the machinery of the Nile. In other words, that the star was the cause or the regulator of the cycle of the Nile. And it's not surprising, therefore, that they use this star as the regulator of the calendar. What's intriguing is that just simply by observation, if you will watch the star over the yearly cycle, you would see that star in the sky for about 9 months at different hours, rising at different times. But there would be a time when that star, like I said earlier, would make its final appearance in the west just after sunset and then disappear for 70 days to reappear again in the east at dawn, exactly 365 days from the beginning of your cycle. That is high precision. I mean, you have a system in the sky that is, you can work it to the nearest second. Having said this, the star that you would observe through that cycle, if you would watch it for 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, you would be spot on. I mean, you'd wait for that day when it would reappear after its 70 days of reappearance, and you could literally swear that it would appear again. However, what intrigued the Egyptians is that on the fourth year, it wouldn't appear. It would be a day late.
No, really?
And the reason is, and I don't want to go too much into the science, but the reason is because of what we call the precession of the equinoxes. There is a motion of our planet that most people are unaware of. I mean, every school boy or school girl will know that our planet is a globe, hopefully, these days, that this globe rotates on its axis for 24 hours, what we call a day, and we get the effect of day and night, that the globe revolves around the sun in 365 days and a bit, and a quarter. And because of that, we get the effects of the season. But the globe also wobbles. It wobbles very, very slowly in a cycle of 26,000 years. And because of this wobble, the sky vault, if you like, the fixed stars, appear to change position and change time at the rising over this long cycle. And indeed, we use this change to be able to date ancient monuments if these ancient monuments are related to the stars. This is the science of what we call archaeoastronomy. I'm an archaeoastronomer, if you like. If a monument is known to be directed to a specific group of stars, then we can date it, because we can use this slow change of the sky to see where it pointed when. So this is the science behind it. Now, the reason that the star appeared one day late after 4 years is because of the slight difference of a quarter of a day difference in the solar year. The year is not exactly 365 days. It's 365 days and a bit. And that bit is not exactly a quarter, but almost a quarter. Now, the Egyptians knew this. They knew this because the star appeared one day late every 4 years. It kind of lost a day, if you like, in its cycle, relative to the cycle of the sun. They knew this, but they did not adjust it as we do. We, in our modern calendar, try to make up for it by adding an extra day every 4 years, which we call the leap year, right?
Right.
Hello, Doug?
Yes, right, correct.
Yeah. But in fact, this quarter of a day that we add is not exactly, because it's not really a quarter of a day. So, well, we won't live long enough, but every 3,000 years, we have to kind of make a little adjustment here. Right? Because we will lose a bit we'll lose a full day every 3,000 years. So, in other words, although we have tuned our calendar close enough, we haven't tuned it precisely. You can't tune it precisely, because you have to sort of twiggle with it all the time. So this is what we've got today. We've got a calendar that is almost synchronized to the cycle of the sun. The Egyptians did not synchronize it. They accepted the way that the universe worked. They didn't want to tamper with the order of the sky. And that's very intriguing, because not only they knew these slight differences, but they didn't touch them. Their calendar was left to drift, if you like. And it is this so-called drifting calendar that is in itself a mystery, because when you leave when you don't tamper with the cycles of the sky, if you like. Incidentally, I should say this, that when the pharaoh became when a king was crowned and became pharaoh of Egypt, he had to take an oath, and the oath that he took was that he would not change the calendar. He would not reform the calendar. He would not adjust it. Which is exactly the contrary of what we do. They did not want to tamper what they call the cosmic order. It was there, and that's the way it was. And therefore, their calendar was left to drift. But because of this drift, it created... Now, for your listeners, I'm going to use an old term, but it created what we call a vernier scale. It kind of gave us a means, and gave them a means, to be able to tell the epochs because of this drift. For example, if I would say I see the star rising 2 days after my calendar date, my New Year date, I would know I would be talking about 8 years, because the drift is one day lost every 4 years. So it's a perfect means to be able to tell dates and time without the artificial calendar, without what we have today, which is an artificial calendar. For example, we say we're 2008, and we say 2008 from where? Well,
yeah,
most people would
exactly.
say, well, from the date of... Hello?
Yes, exactly. 2008 from what?
Exactly. So we're 2008 from some sort of event, which is supposed to be the birth of Jesus. Or the death of Jesus, depends how you want to take it. But it's definitely not the date of our planet. Our planet is 4.5 billion years old. So it's really a convention that we use. I mean, indeed, we run our planet today with several calendars. There is the so-called Islamic calendar, which dates with the moon. And so as far as the Muslims are concerned, we're about 1,460-something. They're behind us by 600 years in terms of their calendar. We have the Jewish calendar. We have, even in Iran, they used to use the Persian calendar. So these calendars are artificial. They're merely an artificial way of timing and telling dates, whereas the Egyptians did not. They used the real date of the planet. They used the
that is absolutely fascinating. That's completely fascinating. Robert, we gotta take a quick break. About 3-4 minutes of commercials, and we'll be right back with more of Robert Balval. Please do not go away. This is gonna be fascinating. See you in 4 minutes. Foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of the Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. Have you ever thought about owning a telescope? I mean a really good telescope. Well, at the Discovery Store, you can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping. They have come a long way, you know. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. There is no better way to view the sun than with a coronoscope. Trust me, you will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You might just save the planet. So plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from Eastern Washington State up against the Canadian border. It's cold and rainy outside, my AccuWindow forecast. We're glad you're here. Our guest tonight, very fine, Robert Balval. This is a 3-hour program, so if you're not getting all 3 hours, let us know. We'll get with your affiliate. Hey, Robert, as you were unraveling this mystery, following one discovery to the next, you said in your book that you had to stop thinking like a scientific man and start thinking like the cosmic man. How were you changed by your lifelong quest to discover these mysteries?
Well, in the last 6 months, we've been battered with the Euro-American election. I'm saying this because we were all focused on what was happening in the United States. And by the way, let me say that even here in the Gulf, your listeners might be pleasantly surprised that there is a great euphoria on the choice of Barack Obama. I mean, I've just arrived in the Arabian Gulf, and I was in a shopping mall today, and people mistake me for an American, because every foreigner here is kind of assumed to be an American, with the oil industry. And they were all saying, "Welcome, Obama," you know. It's kind of intriguing. I'm saying this because the focus was obviously on the United States. Having said this, you know, we tend to forget that, we're not just a planet here. We're not just a group of countries. We begin to think global. We begin to think, you know, everything works together. If anything, this financial crisis has revealed is that we're all on the same ship here. We're all on the same house, the same planet. It all works together. We would like to think, or we did think, that it was separated in nice little portions and so forth. But the whole thing works together. But having said this, we're not just a planet. We're a planet in a solar system. There are other 9 planets around here. We're just one of them. And to expand the scale of what we're talking about, out there is millions and zillions. I mean, the number is uncountable. Of stars that contain planetary systems like we. I mean, so, you know, we tend to forget that we're in the cosmos. We're not just on a planet. And the Egyptians, in a sense, were very aware of this because of the belief systems and the ideologies that they had developed. And in a way, by studying the ancient Egyptians, I was forced to see myself as a member of the cosmos, because that's how they saw themselves. Incidentally, the phrase, the word cosmology and cosmopolitan, by the way, was coined in Egypt. It was coined when the Greeks came to Egypt with Alexander the Great and founded the city of Alexandria, which became this great universal city. I come from Alexandria, by the way. I'm a native of Alexandria. And they saw themselves not as Alexandrians or Egyptians. They saw themselves as cosmopolitans. They belong to the cosmos. And this is a fascinating way of thinking of ourselves, because that's what we are. Who raised this again, by the way, is the late cosmologist Carl Sagan, the American cosmologist, who wrote the famous Cosmos book. Many of your listeners will remember there was a wonderful television series called Cosmos. And he reminded us that we are members of the cosmos. We belong to a much vaster and more mysterious environment. We are creatures and citizens of the universe. So to me, this is how I think of myself. I mean, I travel around the world, and I do travel a lot. I do not think that I'm in America or in Italy. I mean, these are just names. I'm in the cosmos. I'm here. And I happen to be on this planet that is incidentally next to a star. You were saying earlier that the ancient Egyptians or the Egyptologists said there was a solar religion. And I'm saying that there is a stellar religion. The evidence is pointing to the stars and the alignments of the stars. But we tend to forget that the sun is a star. The sun is a star. We are a little planet going around a star. We happen to call it the sun. We have our own star next to us. And to me, this is how I think. This is how I see myself. I see myself in this environment. And wouldn't it be nice if we managed to spread this way of seeing ourselves? We would dispense with all these conflicts that we have of seeing each other different, with different ideas, with different religions, with different races. We're not. We're all cosmopolitan. So I hope I've answered your question.
Yes, answered it thoroughly. You know, you discovered, much to the surprise of modern Egyptologists who inherited the legacy of the pharaohs, that the pyramids were not cemeteries, but they were actually centers of regulation from which the king could control the cosmos. So how did this work for them? I mean, I'm an engineer, and I've worked on a lot of projects, and I can tell you as projects are handed from one engineer to another, they kind of take on a new life, new equipment, new discoveries, new techniques, new solutions for old problems. But it seems like the pyramid complexes, and we're talking about thousands of years of continuous construction, they didn't change. They didn't change the way they were built. They didn't change their engineering. They didn't change their design or their focus. So how did the kings hand along this design, one to another, and not change?
This idea of change, although we're in dire need of change today, mostly to come from the United States, but the Egyptians did not have this desire to change. You're absolutely right. And the reason being is that they were very, very happy with what they had. They had devised very early what we today would call a social cultural system that to them was perfect. Indeed, they were very much against change. I mean, they believed that they had found the perfect way to live in harmony on this planet. They lived in harmony with the cycles of the Nile, with the cycles of vegetation. They believed, by the way, which is something that we could learn from them, that everything was sacred. They venerated everything in nature, everything in the world around them. They had great respect for nature, for life. And they did not want to change this because they believed that they had found the ideal way. And indeed, they probably did because they're the only civilization, by the way, that existed in harmony and with a wonderful creativity. Because this is what they left us, this amazing art and architecture that survived for 3,000 years. And they probably would have carried on surviving. We'd probably all be ancient Egyptians or modern Egyptians today had it not been for the destructive forces that came to stop this. It came from the West, by the way. It came from Rome, which had a completely different outlook of power and change. And so, really, this idea of change is kind of bizarre if you think about it. You know, we want to progress. We think that progress. But we've created a system, by the way, and we're learning the hard way, with the crisis now, is that we've created a world that needs to grow. And we cannot sustain it. We cannot make this world grow all the time. Because in effect, to make it grow, we have to actually eat this world up. Because every time you buy a cell phone, every time you buy a new car, you're actually eating the planet. Because that's where it comes from. The materials that you buy actually comes from the planet. So we can't go on like this. And the Egyptians seem to have understood this. They did the reverse to us. They did not want to change. They did not want to tamper with the gifts that they were given. So this is a wonderful way of looking at this. This is other than their cosmological way of looking at themselves. Now, coming to the engineering side, which... by the way, what kind of... You're a construction engineer, are you? Or
No, I'm actually a quality engineer. I put systems together and make plants work more efficiently. I put chemistry and electronics and mechanical engineering together to work as a system.
Hey, we come from the same background. I used to be a quality control engineer in the building industry.
Oh, yeah, okay. Great.
Okay, so we understand each other.
So we have a statistical understanding then.
We do indeed. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, I don't need to explain too much to you, but let me just say this, that I worked in mega projects in the Middle East. I mean, some of the projects I worked were in Saudi Arabia at the time of the big oil boom, where the biggest construction projects were undertaken, like the Riyadh Airport and the famous Riyadh University, which was the single most expensive fixed price contracts in the world in those days. I mean, these people were thinking in billions of dollars rather than millions. So I've seen big, big engineering projects. But I can tell you, even today, with all the technology and the management know-how that we have, it's very, very difficult to plan a project that exceeds 5 or 6 years. You know, because things will change. The economy will change, the management will change, the clients will change. So, to think that in ancient times, 5,000 years ago, they sustained a construction project over generations, let alone 5 years, is in itself a wonderful feat.
Absolutely.
Because it's hard. Hello? Yeah. Go on.
Yes, absolutely. I'm there with you, which kind of is hard evidence coming from where you and I come from. It's hard evidence that this was not an Egyptian project. It was led, directed, designed, and laid out by a much older, much more patient civilization.
Yes. I'd like to reword this for you, because what you're saying is quite correct, but in a sense, it's not perhaps the right thing to say that they weren't Egyptians. As a matter of fact, anything beyond 2,000 years ago was not Egyptians in the sense that the word didn't exist.
Sure.
The Egyptians didn't call themselves Egyptians, the ancient Egyptians. They called themselves something entirely different. They were the people from Kemet. They called themselves the people from the Black Land. And that's intriguing, because we have always supposed that this meant the land of Egypt, which looks a bit dark, because it's a soil, we call this the Teen soil. It's a kind of very fertile soil that's kind of very dark. But I'm beginning to believe that they actually meant the black land, that they came from a black source, which we will get into, because there is no doubt in my mind at all, as it might shock some people, that the Egyptian civilization, and probably civilization as a whole, has black origins. We come from a black source. And I'll deal with this in a little while. But having said this, the ancients of Egypt, that's the best way to call them, certainly were responsible for this project. The question is when, and where did they come from? And these are the questions that I think we're beginning to find the answers. Until recently, the Egyptologists set a kind of scenario saying that, somehow they just developed very quickly and out of the blue started building pyramids, and they had a ready-made architecture, and they had a ready-made language, and they had a ready-made astronomy, you know. It doesn't fit, you know.
Yeah, no.
It doesn't work.
Nothing but bronze tools, no wheels, and no pulleys. Yeah, I was going to say nothing but bronze tools, no pulleys, and no wheels. And they just burst onto the scene designing and building something like this.
Yeah, I mean, let alone the construction, but the design. I mean, as you know, in this field, we're looking at different phases of a project. I have a brother who's an architect, by the way, so we discuss these things quite a lot. But we're looking at any building project, whether it is today or 1,000 years ago, has to be planned. You know, you have to conceive the idea. So we're looking at the planning stage, we're looking at the design stage, then we look at the management stage, and then we look at the construction. So the construction really comes, which is the hard bit, but it comes at the end of this huge phase. And today, if we were to plan something like the construction of the Great Pyramid, as you well know, we wouldn't simply start just like that. We would really plan this project very accurately, because it's a massive project that would take several decades to build, and we would have to be very, very sure not only where we would put the building, but how we would build it, how much it would cost, and the duration, and the management team that would put there. So it's a huge, huge planning exercise. If we could, I remember once speaking to a military man in Egypt from the American embassy, and he said something rather intriguing about this. He said, you know, all this mystery about why they were built and how they were built, but a lot of people forget how they were managed. Because if we could manage today a workforce over several generations with that kind of precision and order, I'd love to know how, because we have a problem doing that even in the military, as we are discovering in Iraq. You know, it's not easy to manage a lot of people to do something. And we have the facilities today, you know, we have walkie-talkies and phones and cell phones and radars and telecommunication. You know, we're looking at people who didn't have any form of communication other than the voice. You know, you're going to order, for example, those blocks that are 1,000 kilometers away being quarried. How do you inform the people there? It takes 2 months to do this kind of trip. You know, this is the intriguing part, is to understand how they control this, how they manage. I mean,
think about the blocks themselves. You know, they, when you go inside the King's Chamber and you look up, or you run your hands along the walls, you'll realize that you can't fit a piece of paper between these stones. And it's been thousands of years since they were laid. Now, no phones, no couriers, no one tape measure between the place where they were quarried 1,000 kilometers away and the building site, and there's no evidence that the blocks arrived the wrong size. Everything fit perfectly.
You just hit the nail on the head there, Brooke, because one of the things that is rarely mentioned, by the way, in Egyptological books, is that there is 2.5 million blocks in the Great Pyramid alone. I mean, remember, I said there are 25 of these pyramids around, but let's just deal with the Great Pyramid. There's 2.5 million blocks. Now, the intriguing thing about these blocks is that the pyramid is made up of 200 plus courses. Today there is 203, some of the top is missing. We think there must have been about 220 courses. Now, they're made up collectively of 2.5 million blocks. But the strange thing is that none of the courses are of the same height. Now, you as an engineer would know that this would be a nightmare, because you have these blocks being delivered on the site at different heights, and some would belong to the 10th course, some would belong to the 5th course, and you'd have a huge headache to manage and to give instructions of where to put which block where. So it looks like they not only build those monuments with this kind of precision, but they used a management and control system that even made it harder, or appears to be harder. You know, it's intriguing, because they managed to do it with this kind of strange complication. It's as if they wanted to make it harder themselves. Or, to put it another way, what appears to be hard to us today may not have been hard to them for them then. This is the big question. Let me tell you something about this site, because we also tend to forget that there are other monuments around the pyramid. And there are what we call the auxiliary temples. They're very much in ruin, but they're there for us to see. Each pyramid, let me explain this, has two temples linked to it. One which is butted against the eastern face, which we call the mortuary temple. This is the name the Egyptologists give it. We have no idea what this temple functioned as. But let's just call it the mortuary temple, which is butted against the east face. And then there's a causeway that descends all the way to the valley. And at the end of this causeway is what we call the valley temple. Now, let me tell you that these temples are the intriguing construction element of the site, because they're built with blocks that exceed 100 tons. I mean, we're talking 100 tons here, Brooke. Now, let me just give you a sense of scale and weight here. 100 tons is like, it's like 200 family cars squashed together. I mean, that's 100 tons. And they use these blocks, these huge blocks, to build those temples. Now, not only how did they manage to move these blocks, but the big question is why? Why would they want to use 100-ton blocks? Because we know from the construction of the pyramids that they use much more manageable blocks of about 2 tons. I mean, 2 tons is tough, but at least you can move them around with a small team of men. Whereas 100 to 200-ton blocks, there are some blocks that go up to 200 tons. You need an army, and really not just an army on them, but we're not quite sure how they did it. We're not quite sure how they managed to lift them to heights of about 20 meters. So that's the big question that Egyptologists who are not trained in the construction field or have not done what you call quality control have no idea. I mean, they don't talk about it because they simply cannot confront these enormous questions.
I assume that the black granite blocks were quarried 1,000 kilometers away, and they were quarried. They had to be quarried upstream. And a lot of people have said, well, they put the blocks onto barges, and they floated them down the river, and then they offloaded them off the barges onto some kind of cart, and then carried it to the building site and set it in place. And I asked the question, how many of these blocks are on the bottom of the river? Because sooner or later, somebody's going to make a mistake and capsize a barge with a 50-ton block on it, and it's going to go right to the bottom of the river. 2.5 million blocks in one building alone, and there isn't a single stone on the floor of the Nile.
Well, as far as we know, but... strange that you mentioned this, because there is now, as we are talking, a team that has been set up by the Antiquity Department to actually explore the bottom of the Nile, especially in the Luxor, Upper Egypt area. But what they're finding, strangely enough, is vestiges from the Roman period, but nothing from the ancient Egyptians. The ancient Egyptians seem to performed very well.
That's funny.
Whereas the Romans sank a lot of barges there. And we think that the Romans were far more advanced. Let me give you an analogy of what it takes to move this kind of block. As you may know, some of the giant obelisks of ancient Egypt were taken to various capitals of the world. You have one in the United States, which is in Central Park, by the way. There are a few in London, but the majority are in Rome. But the largest one, the heaviest one, is in Paris. It's at the Place de la Concorde, the famous obelisk of the Concorde, which came from the Temple of Heliopolis. From the Temple of Luxor in Upper Egypt.
Right.
Now, let me tell you that the organization of bringing this obelisk, which weighs about roughly close to 150 tons, it took 25 years for the French to organize and bring this obelisk from Egypt to France. And it took the construction of a special ship, a modern special ship, to bring it to France. So this gives you an idea of what it takes to move a block of this size. And yet the Egyptians did this operation thousands of times, not just once. I've studied this. I've written a book, by the way, with Graham Hancock on these strange edifices that you find all over the world. I mean, there is only one obelisk that was brought into France, and it took something like 15 years to organize the bringing of this obelisk. And this is what annoys me when you find academics saying, you know, they put the blocks on barges and they slay them down the Nile and then they drag them up the pyramid. Like we say in this trade, it's easier said than done.
Yeah, you know, it sounds like a non-engineer making that explanation.
Yeah, I mean, a statement is very easy to say, but go out there and do it and it becomes something else entirely. I mean, I can tell you, just one block. I mean, I've seen workmen in Egypt today. If you would tell... In fact, anywhere in the world, if you would tell a construction company that you would want to move a 200-ton block over a 1,000-kilometer distance and raise it to a height of 50 meters, and you would tell him that you would have to do it without any machinery, without any metal tools, without any pulleys, literally without anything, he would laugh at you. I mean, he would say, how do you want me to do it? And he would say, well, you know, just use brutal manpower and get it done, you know. It doesn't work that way, you know. We tend to forget the in-between of these statements that are made. You know, they quarried the blocks in Aswan and Upper Egypt, and they brought them to the pyramids. You can write this in two sentences, but it's 25 years of organization and planning. And you do need devices, you need some means to lift those blocks and put them on the barges. I mean, have you ever tried to put a 200-ton block on a barge?
I wouldn't have the slightest idea how to do that. You know,
but I wouldn't either. I mean, you know, I would certainly want a crane there for a start, you know. So, you know, these are the things that baffle me in the way that these monuments are being studied. You know, I'm the black sheep of Egyptologists, you know, I'm the sort of black native of Egyptologists, they call me. Because I tend to get annoyed with this kind of approach, but this is the truth. I mean, I had the privilege, because I do have contrary to believe that I'm an Egyptological basher. It's not true. I mean, I was very, very close to one of the greatest Egyptologists of our century, the late Professor Edwards, who was, incidentally, the specialist in pyramid studies. We had a long, long friendship. Indeed, he is the one who encouraged me to publish my work. Now, Professor Edwards, with all due respect that I have for him, is a great Egyptologist, great man, but he was not a construction engineer. And yet, you know, he, being in the field, he had to somehow explain how these pyramids were built. And in his famous book, The Pyramids of Egypt, he does. He has a chapter at the end which says how the construction of pyramids. When I discussed this with him, I said that if I would show him today the documents for a construction project of much smaller scale, it would fill half of his room. You know, and he wrote a little chapter about how the pyramid was built. As you well know, the document of a construction project would involve the specifications, the plans, the drawings, the management team, the instruction books, the manuals. You'd fill half a room of documents here to explain how to build a pyramid, right?
Right, so, and you'd have to find suppliers that were reliable, that had quality standards that met yours, and had a similar language, similar mathematics and measurement systems. You know, this shocks the average person to think about, but it's clear that this technology originated somewhere else. It was already figured out, already laid out and organized. And I say this simply because of the immensity and the scope of their work had no precursor on Earth. And it has been copied in principle by peoples who never even knew the Egyptians existed. There are pyramids in South America, in the Yucatan, in China, now in Bosnia. And, you know, many of them came way, way after the Egyptian pyramids. But they didn't travel to Egypt to be taught how to build these things. They just knew. They were just taught by some common source. So, and the alignment, you know, if you utilized a modern computer program, I think you used SkyPro or something like that, you can identify the alignment. But they didn't have any such technology. So how did they align these structures so perfectly with a star that's 8.5 light years away?
Yeah, okay, well, let's look into this, but I'd like to finally close this business of the construction side.
Okay.
You see, I'm going to be a bit humorous here because sometimes one has to be to make a point. I remember about 15 years ago when the famous German robotic engineer, I don't know if you recall the exploration that we did inside the Great Pyramid to explore the shafts in the early 90s. Rudolf Gantenbrink, a German engineer, had built a miniature machine, a kind of robotic machine, a kind of like a Mars rover. Machine that we placed in the so-called shafts of the Great Pyramid, the star shafts, because the ones in the Queen's Chamber did not protrude out of the monument, they did not pierce the monument. So clearly they went somewhere, But surprisingly, no Egyptologist had been curious enough to explore them. And when he did explore them, he discovered at the end of the shaft doors, or what appears to be doors, which incidentally haven't been opened yet. But I remember having a fantastic discussion with this man, many discussions, but one of them went in those lines. You know, I pretended that I was the building contractor, and he was the architect giving me the, making me a requisition of material. And we had a kind of gag that we used to do in conferences, by the way, to hit the point of how absurd it is to look at it in terms of how the Egyptologists do. You know, we did a kind of telephone gag, you know, where he would call me and say, hello, I'm the architect of the Pharaoh, and I want to build a pyramid. And I'd say, okay, well, what do you want? And he'd say, well, I want to build a pyramid which is 146 meters high, with blocks. And I'd say, okay, well, you know, we haven't done this before, but let me work this out. And then he'd say, I want the chamber in granite, you know. And I would say, well, wait a minute, I mean, you know that we don't have granite where you want to build this pyramid. And he'd say, well, you know, the Pharaoh wants granite. So I would say, well, what size? And he'd say, well, we want that to be 60 tons. You know, I'd say, what? And how do you want me to bring them over? He said, well, you know, you just put them on barges and bring them over. You know, and the conversation went in those directions. And then we get to the three shafts. He said, well, you know, I want to build shafts that point to stars. So I said, well, okay, how do you want them built? He said, we want them to be 20 inches by 20 inches, and we want it to be at a slope running through the monument. And I don't know if you've ever built a chimney that runs at a slope through a building. I mean, that's totally unthinkable. And that's what they wanted to do. So the builder is being able to realize that he's getting this amazing request where he can't even figure the technology and the transport. And then you realize how absurd it is to explain this in the terms that the Egyptologists do. You know, I would laugh myself silly if I would get a phone call from an architect telling me those things, if he told me that he didn't want me to use any equipment. You know, I would call an ambulance and have him carted to the nearest asylum, because it's madness what he wants me to do. And yet, it was done. So this is what intrigues those who are not biased by the ideologies of Egyptologists and insist that we're dealing with a primitive society and something that came out of nowhere. But when you present this to an engineer, or you present this to an architect, and I did on many occasions, like I said, my brother is a well-known architect, we discuss this all the time, they will shake their head and say, I'm sorry, but we can't do this. I mean, we can do it, but you have to allow me to use cranes that lift blocks of this size, you have to allow me to use trucks, you have to allow me to use all sorts of equipment, and high precision, by the way, optical instruments, if you want to lay this monument to the precision that you are asking me. You know, you can't tell me not to use these things, because I simply wouldn't know how to do it. So this is the way to look at the construction of this monument. And you, as an engineer, you know, you know what I'm talking about. It's the absurdity of saying they could align a monument to the precision of 5% of a single degree. Let me tell you how difficult this is. Can I go on, by the way? Look.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. I'm going to give you an analogy, because I like giving analogies. It comes easier to the listener. You know, I don't know if you do this in the States, but in Europe, particularly in England, we play darts, you know, in bars. We have a dart board and we shoot darts. And we shoot these darts at about 15 paces away. And it's very hard to hit the bullseye. I mean, you really have to be a very good dart thrower. These people aim a monument that is 230 meters long on the base, with a precision of 5% of a single degree. Now, I would be rather tasked to be able to align that kind of precision and maintain the precision, because it isn't just aligning, getting a measurement with star alignment. It is to transfer the alignment on the ground and then to place blocks that weigh about 2 tons and maintain this alignment. You know, when Egyptologists say they've aligned the monument, they forget that it's a whole series of operations. And ultimately, you might have drawn a line on the ground, which is precise, but then the builder has to come and put the blocks, and he has to maintain that alignment. And I would be hard-pressed today with optical instruments, not just to get the alignment, but to get labor force to move blocks of 2 tons and making sure that his alignment was sustained. So it's very, very difficult to do, I can tell you. I used to be a setting out engineer, and it's hard to do with modern instruments, let alone if I was going to use, I'm not quite sure what they use. I mean, they're supposed to have nothing. You know, they use ropes and rudimentary measuring instruments. So, you know, it's that kind of outlook that you must have with this type of ancient monument and discuss it in those terms to realize that it is absurd to maintain that we're dealing with a primitive coming out of the hunting, gathering, prehistoric times and started building this monument. Surely there was a much older build-up. We're looking at a much older culture, and maybe a much more advanced culture, and maybe another culture that comes from somewhere where the technology and the know-how had evolved. So, you know, whether it's politically correct to Egyptologists or historians to suggest this, and they get upset, I keep telling them, it's not my problem. I mean, we have to be objective about this. You know, you may not like it, but that's the way it is. You know, we have to really explore this rather than block everything and keep insisting on what is not sustainable anymore. It is not primitive people who built this monument. Full stop. And we have to move on and find out who they were and how they did it and where the know-how came from.
So, right. And we're not talking about, and we're not talking about simply a complex of three pyramids. We're talking, you know, dozens of pyramids. And you had mentioned early in the program that you had made some discoveries in what you call the Egyptian Sahara. And that this, you know, might even broaden the scope of this construction project and how it all ties together, what kind of map it lays out. And I hope we're going to cover the more off-the-tourist track structures such as Abu Sir and Abu Ghraib, because, listeners, these two structures, although in a rather bad state of repair, have technology about them that just boggles the mind. So let's see if we can break into that.
Yep. Okay, well, we did say at the beginning of the program that although we're focusing on the Giza pyramids, which we've been talking so far, and especially the Great Pyramid, one thing that needs to be pointed out here that is very, very intriguing is the fact that there now is emerging, and I'm not alone in this, many, many who are following this line of thought and evidence that all or most of these monuments that are scattered in this wide zone, I mean, let me give you a scale here. We're talking about a zone which is about 40 kilometers long on the west bank of the Nile, about 3 or 4 kilometers wide, and there are clusters, sort of what I call archipelagos, of pyramids, cluster of pyramids all along there. And Egyptologists always believed that they were just haphazardly placed there and they had no relations to each other, which in itself is an absurd statement, because what you realize very quickly when you look at, and especially these days when everybody has access to overhead vision of this site, I mean, all you have to do is Google and have a good look, and you realize very quickly that the position of these monuments are interrelated, that they are all part of a massive plan that somehow links them up with geometrical patterns. In other words, that the whole zone was topographically set out. This completely changes the picture here. We're not talking just about the difficulty of building this monument, but we're talking now of a massive plan that involves all the monuments, that they're all associated to each other, that they're all interlinked. In other words, that there seems to have been a plan at the origin that not only, as Egyptologists tell us, it's one pharaoh said, I'm going to build the pyramid, and the other one says, afterwards, I'm going to build a bigger pyramid, and so on. No. We're looking at a plan that was hatched at the very beginning to lay out these 20 or 30 pyramids that are strewn there in relation to each other. And we have to answer the question now as to why. What was this plan about? What did they have in mind? You know, why did they want to terraform this landscape in such a way? What was their purpose? And that's the new approach to this study, is that the evidence is there. You know, when you talk to an astronomer, when you talk to a mathematician, there is no speculation here. An alignment is an alignment. In Egyptology, there is all sorts of discussion in the humanistic side of the problem. You know, one can debate what the text means, and we can go on and say it means that and that. When it comes to an alignment, there is no debate. An alignment which is 28 degrees east of north is an alignment that's 28 degrees of north. It doesn't matter how many people you come to debate. So this is where now the right people, the astronomers, the archaeoastronomers, the mathematicians, the architects, the engineers, are getting into the study, because these are the people that you need to appreciate the approach of how to look at these structures, rather than to argue and come to nowhere. We really have to get down to the nuts and bolts of this. Well, there is no more argument. You know, we have demonstrated beyond any doubt that the Great Pyramid is aligned to the astronomical direction. That is aligned to specific stars. There's no more debate here. It's a fact. We've demonstrated, and this is the new one, by the way, that the Great Pyramid location, they put it there not because they thought it was a nice place and because it has a nice view. They put it there for a very, very specific reason, because it was part of a plan. They had to put it there, because that's where the planners marked the spot, if you like. And there's no question, when you look at the overall area, that you find that the Great Pyramid is positioned in relation to previous monuments, by the way. There were two major cities before the pyramids were built, by the way. There were two major centers of what I suppose we could call universities today. There was a center, which you mentioned earlier, by the way, in the discussion, Heliopolis, the so-called city of the sun, which the ancient Egyptians called Inyunu, the city of pillars. And it is there that was the kind of think tank. The Egyptologists say the priests were there, but I'd rather see them as the antiquity version of scientists. They were astronomer priests. That's the center where they operated. They had pre-existed the pyramid. And elsewhere was a city that eventually the Greeks called Letopolis. This is where another center of astronomical observation would happen. This is where Doxus, the famous Greek astronomer, who came to Egypt to learn from these people. They actually spent time in Letopolis to learn astronomy from the ancient Egyptians. So these two centers were there. And today, surprisingly, I mean, the Egyptologists did not even see this, but any landscape engineer, any engineer who has dealt with setting up monuments and placing monuments, realizes very quickly that these three places, Heliopolis, which is 24 kilometers on the east side of the Nile, away from the Great Pyramid, and the Letopolis, which is due north, about 18 kilometers due north of the pyramid, are interrelated and form a perfect right-angled Pythagorean triangle. Can't miss it. They're obviously interrelated. These things don't happen by luck. And therefore, the location of the Great Pyramid is a design choice. It was actually selected through a design over huge distances. So these people were able to throw measurements with very high precision over 20, 30 kilometers. This is the kind of people we're dealing with. And how they did this with nothing is intriguing, to say the least. So this is what is coming out. And not only that, but we're finding now that other structures, other pyramids that we thought were loosely placed haphazardly are not. They are in relation to either the scheme, geometrical pattern on the ground, or they tie up with the position of celestial bodies. It's as if they kind of replicated a region of the sky where these constellations are, the Orion constellation. They kind of projected a map with very high accuracy and laid these monuments over this vast 40-kilometer field in the same way. And we really have to ask the question, why did they do it? You know, I mean, what motivated them? Now, I presented it in terms of a religious belief, because we really have to fit it. We're trying to fit, if you like, what we call a religious belief in what appears to be a high-technology project. And the word religion becomes more and more dissociated the more you approach it. It doesn't seem to be a religion. It looks like it's some sort of massive plan to perform a function, to say something in a huge scale. And the more one gets to it, it's as if they're trying to leave a message. It's as if, you know, just let's throw an idea. Let's imagine that we would somehow go somewhere in the distant future, in a distant planet. And we'd arrive there, we would try and leave a message. We would try and leave our presence. I mean, otherwise, the whole exercise was futile. You know, we would like to say, we were here. We came here. And we would like to leave it in a manner that was able to sustain the pressures of time, the destruction of the elements, would leave a message that would survive. This is the impression one gets when one looks at these monuments in this kind of massive planning geometrical layout. So, what is this message? Well, I said it earlier. You know, we came from a much older, because the message gives us a date. It says 10,500 BC. And the Egyptologists laugh. They say, well, you know, fine. I mean, we understand. Hello?
Yeah, but that does seem to match up with some more obscure constructions like the Osirian. The Osirian that sits adjacent to Seti's temple obviously was built about 10,000 to 12,000 years ago. Not so with Seti's temple. Two completely different structures just happen to be built adjacent to one another. So, you know, if the case that you're making, if we just look at it logically, it either was left behind by a star-traveling people for us to know where we came from, or it was left by us trying to get former visitors from that star system to return and to leave a map that would last long enough so that it could be seen from space for many, many millennia.
Yeah, I would like, in my mind, I think I would like to take this in steps. The step that I'm investigating now is that the message that Hancock and I deciphered from the Giza Necropolis is it says, we came here 10,500 years ago. Or in fact, what we call 10,500 BC. That's what the message says. So we say, do we take it seriously or is it just hocus pocus? The Egyptologists say it's hocus pocus. There was nothing there in 10,500 BC. And we've been debating this for the last 15 years. And lo and behold, Egyptologists themselves have now been finding evidence in the Egyptian Sahara that shows that there were people there in this country, in this land, thousands of years before the pyramids. And lo and behold, that they had knowledge of astronomy, they had knowledge of the celestial cycles, they even had knowledge, they even had domesticated cattle long before we thought, this is what's coming out now. And it's no more theory. we're now obliged to, or they are obliged to consider this possibility that they had it wrong, that we're looking at a much, much, much older face. That's how I want to approach it, because that's the evidence. What was beyond that phase? Well, we'll leave it for another sector. I mean, did they come from the stars? Did they come from where? But let's approach it in that phase, because this is interesting now. This is really getting hot. We now have hard evidence to look at. And like I was saying earlier in the program, I went, you know, I took the trouble. I mean, I can tell you, I went to a place where you have to travel for about 6 days with four-wheel drives to get there in the open desert. You know, it's one hell of an expedition. And Egyptologists haven't even bothered to go there. And it's surprising because one big discovery was made lately, which hasn't hit the scene yet. This is why I'm in Dubai now, I'm in the Arabian Gulf, to present this discovery with the discoverer. Because about seven months ago, you see, we didn't even think that the Egyptians of, and the ancient Egyptians of the pharaonic period, would even dare to venture in the Sahara. I mean, let me tell you that even today, you really have to be very, very careful when you start stepping out of the Nile Valley and wandering in the desert. You know, we have four-wheel drives, we have GPSs, we have instruments, we have cans to transport fuel, you know. But even then, if you're going to move 400 or 500 kilometers into the deep desert, you better make sure that you know what you're doing. It's a very dangerous expedition. And there was no way that we could imagine the pharaohs with no facilities that we have today that would wander more than a maximum of 100 kilometers in the desert. Now, we know they went to the oasis. On the western side of the Nile, there are a belt of oasis that can be reached by 6 or 7 days' journey by foot. So, yes, they probably did go there, and there is evidence of them having gone there. But beyond there, no way. But lo and behold, 7 months ago, a friend of mine, an Egyptian, by the way, called Mahmoud Marai, discovered pharaonic inscriptions 700 kilometers deep into the Sahara. Now, let me tell you, I went there. I went there to see those inscriptions. And it took us 6 days to get there by four-wheel drive. It was one hell of a trip. And there's no way that I can imagine primitive people doing that on foot. Now, I don't know how they did it. They did it, because the evidence is there. Better still, and I'd like to raise this direction, because this is now the new study. Because now, not only the pharaohs went there, but there is evidence of an ancient culture. It's all over the place. It literally, they left us images of themselves. They left us pictures, because it's full of drawings on... Now, let me explain the area. Can I go on, by the way, because I can't...
Yeah. Let's keep going for about four more minutes, then we'll take a break, and then, please, we'll resume, because this is marvelous stuff.
Okay. Well, let me set the scene before you take the break, so when we return, we can progress in that direction. Let me give you a vision of the landscape we're talking about here. Like I said, Egypt is a kind of elongated land with flanked by deserts in the east. The eastern deserts are what we call the Sinai Peninsula. It's heading towards Israel and Jordan. The western desert is the intriguing desert because it's the Sahara. It's gigantic. Egypt contains parts of the Sahara, and this Sahara extends all the way to the Atlantic on the Moroccan coastline. It's a giant place. And it's as dry as a bone. I mean, no water, there's no vegetation, there's nothing. But that wasn't the case in prehistory. The Sahara was fertile. And when you go there now today, there is evidence not just of amazing fertility and that must have been there. I mean, you see fossilized trees and you even see sea animals, fossilized sea animals. It was a very fertile area. Now, the geography of Egypt is such that In the distant south, you hit the Sudanese border. And in the extreme southwest, literally the corner of Egypt, is the most intriguing landscape that you can imagine. Indeed, it has been studied by NASA because it resembles Mars. It's like you are on Mars when you get there, because what you have is the flattish desert, you know, with dunes and shallow canyons, and you travel for 5 days to get there. But when you get there, it's like this giant iceberg that springs out of the desert, a sort of mountain range, the size of Switzerland. If you can imagine Switzerland without any trees, that's what you have there. Very mysterious, it's very intriguing, and it's totally unexplored. As a matter of fact, it was found in 1920, hardly a century away. You didn't even know it was there 100 years ago. And it's not been properly explored. And there is the evidence that we're looking for. And we'll leave that for after your break.
Wow. Fascinating, absolutely fascinating. Don't go away, because we're going to come back for our third and final hour. We're going to go someplace no one's ever gone, in Egypt. To learn of the mysteries with my guest, Robert Balval. We'll be right back after this. Down at NRG Resources have introduced the new engine oil technology. TVT 24/7 is the future of lubrication. This is the industry's first environmentally friendly oil additive that not only increases fuel mileage, it reduces engine, gearbox, and transaxle wear to nothing. The other brands fail anti-friction testing in less than 10 minutes under standard testing conditions. TBT 24/7 went more than 24 tests and still did not fail. Get tomorrow's technology today by visiting the online store at X Squared Radio and pick up TBT 24/7 Engine Oil Energizer. There is some place you should visit before. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the six-part series is now available for pre-purchase at $5 off. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel. But you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today. If you have survived the disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back to the third and final hour of X Squared Radio. My guest tonight is Robert Balbal. We're about to go deep into the Egyptian Sahara. Join us. Phone lines will be open this final hour, but you might want to just sit back and listen. We're about to go where no one's gone before. Welcome back, Robert. Okay, now we're deep into the forbidden zone of the Egyptian Sahara, which was, according to you and others, a lush, green, forested, mountainous area many thousands of years ago, but today is hidden among the bone-dry sands of the Sahara. So, what did you discover when you went there?
Let me, as I always do, give you a bit of a background here before we take our journey. There's two stories that, by the way, will be told in a book that I'm preparing with an American astrophysicist, a fellow called Thomas Brophy. It's going to be called Black Genesis. And you, for obvious reasons, or rather reasons that will become obvious, as I tell you all about it. The first story, strange enough, starts with an American team that were studying the prehistoric sites of the Sahara in the what we call the southeastern part of ancient of Egypt, the southeastern part of the Sahara, flanking the Nile, the region of where the Temple of Abu Simbel is, that's in the extreme south of Egypt. Now we knew from many, many decades before that there was a lot of prehistoric vestiges, not just in Egypt, but in the Tunisian part of the Sahara and the Moroccan part. What we didn't know is this. This American team, by fluke, were coming back from an expedition and heading towards the Nile area of Abu Simbel. They were about 100 kilometers away from the Nile. Now, the head of this expedition is now a retired anthropologist called Fred Wendell. And he and his bunch of students from the Southern Methodist University of Texas, by the way, stopped to have what they called a comfort break. They stopped to have a pee. And when they were out there having their comfort break, they realized that they were standing in an area which was full of prehistoric artifacts. All sorts of things on the ground that, being anthropologists, they quickly realized that they had hit, by luck, an ancient prehistoric site. Now, they knew many ancient prehistoric sites. This was nothing very unusual. What was unusual about this place was that as they began to look more closely, they began to realize that there was this huge boulder sticking out of the ground all over the place. And these boulders appeared to be in geometrical patterns. They appeared to form alignments. And they even found a circle that looked like a mini Stonehenge. And they began to really intrigue them. And they set up a project there. It took them quite a while to realize that this strange ceremonial site, they call it Now, it's in a region called NAFTA. You're going to hear a lot about the so-called NAFTA Playa area. And although the discussion has been going on in academic circles, I'm going to bring it out full blast into the public because of the discoveries that we're making now. It took them quite a while, in fact, more than 20 years, to realize that they weren't looking merely at a prehistoric site. Because what happened is that Fred Wendorf began to think that these stones that are kind of put in this kind of strange alignment and pattern may have something to do with astronomy. And he brought over to the site in the late 90s an astronomer from Boulder, Colorado, a fellow called Ken Malvel, who is also now close to retirement. And Ken Malvel immediately realized that what he was looking there was an ancient, historic, astronomical site. But what was intriguing wasn't that alone, was that the dating that the anthropologists were getting from carbon dating made it that this prehistoric astronomical site was thousands of years older than Stonehenge, the oldest astronomical site that we know from prehistory. And that was a shocker. We had no idea that what we thought was primitive people in the Sahara practiced that kind of astronomy. And lo and behold, the alignments, many of these alignments, were directed to stars, and they were directed to those very stars that the ancient Egyptians later on used to align the pyramids. They were aligned to the constellation of Orion, to the star Sirius, to the northern stars of the Big Dipper, by the way, which the northern shaft of the Great Pyramid point. So that was a huge, huge discovery here, because suddenly we realized that the astronomy that we allocated to the ancient Egyptians of the pyramid builders did not come from them. It came from these people who existed in the Sahara thousands of years before. And the evidence was there. What has changed since then is that it has drawn many anthropologists and researchers to take a bigger look at this, not just at the NAFTA Playa site that I've just described. But one of the experts that has studied this from the astronomical point of view is an astrophysicist who used to work for NASA, by the way, who is now my colleague, a fellow called Thomas Brophy, Dr. Thomas Brophy, who went to this site in 2003 to examine more closely this astronomical alignment. And what he realized was that, again, like the pyramid builders, remember I said that what we discovered at Giza was that they were giving us this much older date in their message. They were saying, we were here in 10,500 years ago. What this site was saying when it was examined by Thomas Brophy was that although the carbon dated gave us already a very ancient date of about 6,000 to 7,000 BC, which is 3,000 years before the pyramid builders, the astronomy gave us an older date. It said we were here in 16,000 BC. This was a shocker. They kept telling us that they came from even an older time. And the more we studied the site, the more a sophisticated astronomy began to emerge. It's as if they, for example, they tracked the stars over time. They literally were there. Now this is amazing because we have carbon dating of the presence of these people, whoever they were, by the way, from around 6,000 to 8,000 BC, we're talking a long, long time before the pyramid, and they stayed in that area till 3,500 BC. Now that date rings a bell, because this is when these people disappeared, and when the pharaonic civilization began to emerge, and clearly the twain meet, because this is matches what we know from the geological and climatic conditions of the Sahara. The Sahara, we know, was very fertile for the simple reason that the climate in these distant prehistoric times was very different. You had the great monsoons in Central Africa, raining, pouring downpours of massive rain in the central parts of Africa around the time of the summer solstice, because the huge liberation of frozen waters in the highlands of Central Africa would melt in the summer and cause this enormous downpours of rain. But because of the way that the climate was then, these monsoons would reach the southern parts of Egypt. It would actually drench the Sahara in the summertime. And it would form these kind of temporary gigantic lakes. And it was almost paradisical. You had this wonderful, almost Shangri-La landscape of lakes and wonderful pastoral fields. And this was very hospitable for people to come and settle there. But as the climate began to change, it forced the people to move around, because these lakes that were formed during the rains were temporary. They would last roughly from June to February, and then the water would literally drain into the sand. And as the climate became warmer and warmer, these lakes became scarcer and scarcer. And it forced the people to devise two essential aspects that would spawn civilization. One of them was to learn how to navigate. They had to move around this vast area of the Sahara to find the lakes. And they literally had to learn how to do that, and they used the stars the way we learn to navigate in the open ocean. But they not only had to learn how to move around, they had to learn how to move around at a special time of the year to make sure that when they got to these areas of the lakes would be full of water. They couldn't miss. They couldn't get there too early. Their life literally depended on it. And therefore, they began to devise calendars. They began to understand how the celestial machine above them could be used and understood so that they could time and they could navigate around. This is where astronomy was born. This is where it began. And they had to carry food. It forced them to domesticate the wild animals around them. It forced them to literally take cattle from one place to the other. To use the word of Professor Wendorf, they had their walking larder. They had to have these walking fridges, if you like, which were the cattle. And we have evidence of this beyond any doubt, that these people, long, long before we thought it happened, had spawned the two elements that are necessary for a development of a full-blown civilization. The knowledge, the mathematical knowledge, the understanding of the machinery of the sky. You need to know geometry, you need to develop a form of rudimentary sighting devices. And the evidence is there, it's all over the place. I mean, it's not just at the Nabta Playa, which in itself is so intriguing because of all these alignments that have been found there. We have been finding, as we move around the Sahara, stone circles and strange structures. They're all over the place. I mean, clearly there was a massive culture there that has totally disappeared. Now, that's the one side of the story. The other side of the story, we have to fall back to 1923. Are you still there, Brooke?
Oh, yes, I'm still here. I haven't gone anywhere.
Okay. Let me give you the other side of the story, because this is where we come to the sexy part of the exploration. In the 1920s, until the 1920s, we had no idea what was in the remote Sahara. The simple reason is that we didn't have the means to travel there, and it was very, very dangerous, as I was saying earlier, to venture deep into the Sahara with just camels and donkeys. One of the big problems you realize very quickly when you have to move these vast distances is water. You have to carry so much water with you that just for a couple of human beings, you need a huge caravan trail to carry the volume of water that you're going to need over this long period of time in order to penetrate the Sahara to these kind of depths. So, having said this, it's only in 1926 that an Egyptian explorer, a fellow called, I'm getting the time, Muhammad Ibrahim, who was educated in the British Army, and was fascinated by this unexplored. He wanted to go in areas that were totally unexplored. And he traveled. He did the first exploration of the Egyptian Sahara, and he traveled from the northern coastline of the Mediterranean, 3,000 kilometers to reach this remote, extreme area of the southwest of Egypt. And when he went there, he discovered this region that I was telling you about, this mountain region nobody knew was there. He only managed to spend a few days time because he was running out of water, but it was during that first visit to the place that he stumbled. I mean, when you get there, I've been there recently, there is no life at all. I mean, no human life signs of it at all, or modern human life. Nobody lives there. And when he went there, he assumed that there would be no one there. And he set camp in the middle of this mountain zone, in one of the valleys. And the story goes that he was woken up by a young girl who brought him a pot of milk. And he was totally stunned with his team of travelers. She was a black girl. She was dressed in very strange clothes. And she spoke a totally alien language. Nonetheless, they managed to somehow communicate with her, and she took them to this place where there was, lo and behold, people living there. We have no idea who they were. They were there, they said, from time immemorial. They called themselves, they had a king, called himself Huni. And they managed to somehow communicate slowly with sign languages. And these people said, we are not the original inhabitants of this place. There were gods here. And they said, what do you mean by God? You know, and then they said, well, let me show you. And they took them to see drawings that were carved on the rocks. They said, this is what our gods left. And what these drawings showed, which immediately was realized, the implications of this by the explorers, was that they were showing creatures, animals, that could not have possibly existed in this environment. There were giraffes, and hippopotamus, and lions, and ostriches, which cannot exist in this environment. These creatures that need a lot of water, a lot of foodstuffs, they literally need forests and jungles. So, clearly, there was a time when there must have existed a different kind of condition in this area. But what was intriguing is that they showed people as well. Now, I'll get to that in a minute, because that's how we discovered this zone. It's today called the Gilf el-Kibir and the Uwainat Mountains. I don't know if you've heard recently that there's been tourists that were kidnapped a month ago in that region. It was all over the news.
No.
Anyway, now, let me tell you, the news will, of course, go back to civilization, and that's when, gradually, the anthropologists and Egyptologists began to pay attention a bit. Because clearly, nobody had no idea that there was this people there. Now, 5 years later, a British explorer went there. And although he found the same location because of the maps that were brought back, he didn't find the people. They had gone. And we've never found them since. We really don't know where they went and who they were. Just gone. So, we started, when I say we, I mean they started looking at these rock drawings. And the more they started looking, the more they found. Now, recently, there's been some tremendous discoveries made by two or three daring explorers who have been there in the last 4 or 5 years. One of them is a fellow called Mahmoud al-Marai. You'll hear a lot about Mahmoud al-Marai because I've now teamed up with Mahmoud al-Marai and Thomas Brophy, because Mahmoud al-Marai made a stunning discovery about 6 months ago. When he went there, to see those rock drawings. He was intrigued and he wanted to see them for himself. He actually discovered a case. It's that kind of place, Brooke, where you can actually make discoveries on a daily basis, because it's totally unexplored. I mean, we went there, like I said, in April, and we actually found a prehistoric village. Mahmoud Marai, when he went there in December last year, discovered a completely unknown prehistoric cave. And this cave, when you go in there, you are mystified, because it looks like it was painted yesterday. I mean, it's unbelievably new, untouched.
Wow.
We've timed it to 8,000 years ago. I mean, that's how old this thing is. And the drawings that you see there are quite extraordinary. I mean, clearly those people are far more sophisticated than we thought. I mean, they have domesticated cattle, they have houses, they have ranches, and they left us drawings of themselves. And they're wonderful looking people. I mean, quite amazing. They're black, they're tall, they wear wonderful ornaments, and they seem to have a damn good time. They show us scenes of them playing around. They show us scenes of them swimming when there is no water. But obviously, there was wonderful scenery around them, because they show us scenes, and they ride giraffes, and they have strange instruments, and so that's what's there. What is intriguing, Brooke, is that although they left us this pictorial evidence, we haven't found them. It's as if they're not there. There is not one single human body that was found there. They seem to have come and gone, you know? The big question is, where do they go? And here comes the bit, because now we're tying all this up. The ancient Egyptians, now we're talking about the pharaohs now, keep on telling us that they had communication with a kingdom called the Kingdom of Yam. And it existed. The question is, where was it? And they say that they used to go to this kingdom of Yam, and it took them 50 days to get there, and they used to trade with these people who were very sophisticated and provide them with all sorts of information and knowledge and goods and whatever. And the Egyptologists always assumed that this kingdom of Yam was somewhere in the south of Egypt, somewhere near the Sudanese border. But everything changed because of the discovery that Mahmoud Marai did. When he was there in December, he was there, I should say, with a Maltese engineer, a fellow called Mark Borda, who is also a very good friend of mine. And totally unexpected, as they were wandering, they had to enter now this mountain region called Uwainat, I'm describing. It's about 30 kilometers long and about 30 kilometers wide. It's kind of like a giant iceberg that sticks out of the desert with valleys and strange internal systems that hasn't been explored properly yet, and it's still there for the taking. They merely skirted the outskirts of this region. And they had to enter Sudan because this kind of iceberg in the desert straddles between Libya, Egypt, and Sudan. It's kind of like it's in three countries, if you like, today. And they had to enter the Sudanese area they wanted to explore this unexplored part of this rock region. And they stumbled on something that sent a shockwave, and will send a shockwave when we expose it properly in Dubai at the end of this month, where I am now. We're doing a major conference on this. They found hieroglyphic writing on the rock. And suddenly everything changed. There is no question at all that the pharaohs went there. And they went there in the very early part of the civilization, because the hieroglyphics give us the name of a king that was at the time of the pyramid builders. The pyramid builders traveled in the Sahara for 700 kilometers and had contact with these people, whoever they were, in this far out region of Uwainat Mountains. But, here is the bit. The statement that they left on the rock is saying, this is the kingdom of Yam. The lost kingdom of Yam has been found, Brooke. We know where it is now. And they left us these images of who they were. What we are intrigued now is that Where are they? I mean, there is no signs, there's no bones, there's no tombs, there's no nothing. Where did they go? And we now are nearly. Hello? Yes?
They picked up and they traveled. Hey, Robert, we have a caller on the line. Let's address the phone call and we'll get right back to the story. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from, please.
Oh, well, my name is Robin and I'm calling from Charlotte.
Hello, do you have a question?
I sure do. I'm just curious. You're talking about a lot of different cultures that you're kind of finding right now. And is it possible, right now, even, you know, we have different cultures around the world, and we have some cultures that are a little more primitive and some that are a lot more modern, you know. If you go to France and that, obviously you have a Western civilization, and these are very sophisticated people there. But if you go into certain parts of Kenya or Africa and that, you have some tribal or native-type people that are very primitive even to this day. I mean, they live... What is to say that... it dawned on me that when you're talking about all the artifacts that they're starting to find all over the world and how extensive and how sophisticated some of these are, if you go to the Mayans, I'm not sure how you pronounce that, but then you go to Egypt, and like you said, Bosnia and that, you're looking at pyramids, you're looking at some pretty sophisticated building techniques, you're looking at them everywhere. Is it possible that this planet was populated, much like it is today, with a lot of different cultures and people? And that catastrophes that have happened, throughout the last 12,000 years or so have kind of knocked out some of those civilizations, and to where we became a little more primitive and we're coming right back up to speed again. Because when you look at how fast our cultures and Western civilization has risen in the last, 300 years, I mean, we've basically gone from horse and buggy to landing on the moon and putting rovers on Mars. I mean, it's real, real fast, this explosion. Who's to say that this didn't happen 200,000 years ago? Or why do we keep thinking that everything started somewhere around 10,000 years ago? Where?
Good question. Sorry, can I? Hello?
Yeah.
I get your question, and you're absolutely right to raise this question. But I think that what we really have to start with is to remind everybody that we have a common soul. And, no anthropologist would contest it. We do come from a common source, and this common source seems to be in the Rift Valley of Central Africa. This is where it all began. And somebody described it as a gigantic cesarean operation. You know, there's literally a cut in the earth. Sorry, are you still there, everybody? Because
yes, I am.
Strange noises. Yeah.
Yes, we're here.
Yeah, in Central Africa, in what is modern Kenya today, going all the way to the Ugandan region, is literally a giant cut in the earth. We call it the Rift Valley. And it is in there, somehow, it's a kind of, I like to describe it as a cesarean operation, because it looks like the earth kind of split at this part and emerged from it what we now are. I mean, we come from there. This is the beginning. And clearly, it spreads. What I've been describing in the Egyptian Sahara is a later phase from this early, very embryonic beginning of the human adventure.
Yeah, but wait.
It spreads.
Well, can I ask you something? And I don't mean to interrupt, but you just said we found a cave, and it indicates that there was a people here, okay? But we have no sign of the people. And then you go on to say, but we know 130,000 years ago in Africa, this is where everything started. And yet, you just said we saw something that's even more recent, but we still don't know where the people. Who's to say 200,000 years ago there's stuff and you can't find the people? You know? I mean, why would you put it there? Why wouldn't you speculate at least and say, if it can happen in a more recent period of time, where we would actually say, we don't have any evidence of people, but we have their artifacts, what makes you think that there isn't also people that were here and you have their artifacts that are much older than even where you're going to Africa? I mean, it's kind of naive to think that it just starts there. Because we have Homo sapiens sapiens that's around records of it 200,000 years ago.
Yes.
So,
you're right. Let me just say that we first of all, we have to follow the trail. I mean, we can speculate till the kingdom come, but ultimately we have to follow an evidence trail. I should say that, because I was saying earlier that I'm here on a special mission, I'm actually preparing for a conference that is actually going to look and discuss all these points that you've raised. We're having, coming here, you may, since you seem to be knowledgeable about the questions about our origin, we have the well-known, very radical anthropologist, researcher, an American called Michael Fremo, who's coming here. He wrote a book called Forbidden Archaeology.
Yeah.
Which, if you haven't read, you should. Hello?
Yes, I have read it, actually, both of them.
Yeah, well, there you are. So you're aware of all these aberrations that we have in understanding our past, because as Michael Fremo and Richard Thompson, his colleague, showed in the research, is that we have some things that are totally inexplicable. We're having evidence of human presence that is far, far earlier than anthropologists are ready to consider.
Right, and you're even having evidence of high technology and then all of a sudden a surge in no technology. You know, you're going from like a Cadillac in the middle of the desert, right, like a pyramid, and then you're going into a people that looks like they're pretty sophisticated to instead of the, you know, the evolution of the culture getting more and more sophisticated, like, you know, we seem to think it should happen, it went where people were back to living in tents and, you know, subsisting off the, you know, desert and pretty primitive lifestyle. I mean, when you start seeing where the technology goes backwards instead of forward, and you've got evidence with the pyramid right there, sitting there, why wouldn't you want to speculate, at least start looking at this? This is probably a truth, maybe a hidden one, but it looks like there's little bits of evidence here and there that shows that this is probably, we've had some pretty high-tech civilizations on this planet that have not been able to survive and been wiped out for whatever reasons, and then we keep kind of like we go to these high and lows, where we start rebuilding again the cultures and getting more sophisticated, and then bam, we're back down into the desert and we're living like Indians.
Okay, well, I mean, yeah, you've said one or two things that, and particularly something related to me. I mean, you keep saying, why won't I speculate? Let me tell you, I'm Mr. Speculation here. I mean, I've brought what Egyptologists consider speculative theories that have shaken all these rigid established views about our origin. So, but there is a way of speculating and there is another way of speculating. And I think that, you know, I'm one of these believers that one can speculate in a step-by-step level where the evidence allows us to speculate. I'm not afraid to speculate. But there's no point me throwing a wild idea if there is no at least some evidence to back it. But I do agree with you that we do, I believe that we have a wrong view of our origin. And many things do not fit, and you're absolutely right. I mean, we have aberrations. Now, there are some explanations why some cultures appear to be more sophisticated and others not. We also can enter the discussion of what we mean by sophisticated. Because I'm a great believer. For example, one of the arguments that is often brought against this kind of approaches, against the idea that we're dealing with a much older culture, is that you know our opponents, the academics, would say, well, where is the evidence? I mean, where are the cities? Where are the artifacts? Where are the tools? You know, but sometimes one gets the impression that, you know, we tend to judge sophistication and we tend to judge the signs of civilization by buildings, you know, and if we see temples and monuments and tools and artifacts. Well, these are perhaps one of the things that have been judged, but much of it, I mean, when you look at ancient Egypt, it looks like there was a period where there was quite the opposite. There was a kind of non-explosion of this kind of development. It was more of a sophisticated civilization of the mind. We're looking at very concentrated pockets of intelligent people that have not left us the signs because it wasn't the way they were thinking. But you're absolutely right. There are many things that we need to explain. We need to explain, for example, indeed, why we're not finding more evidence of human presence in certain parts of the world. I mean, really, when I was speaking about the Rift Valley, I mean, we based our knowledge of the sources of human life out of three or four skeletons that we found there. And the goalpost keeps changing. I mean, we 50 years ago, we were talking about 200,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And then suddenly we're speaking about 2 million years ago. And now you find that anthropologists are ready to speak about human evolution 7 million years ago. I mean, everything changes all the time because we cannot rigidly hold to a model, because the truth of the matter is that we not only have not properly explored. I mean, really, it's quite amazing. We are in the 21st century. We have the means to do it. And yet, there is two major explorations in Egypt alone, I'm not even speaking about the rest of the world, where the Sahara region that I was describing. I mean, you would have thought that anthropologists would now have poured into the area to try and work out, first of all, who are these people?
Oh, yeah.
Well, absolutely, but I mean, you know, this is one of the weirdest things about archaeology, is that it's extremely slow and it's extremely complacent. I mean, I'll give you another one
Well, I was going to say, one of the things that we've very clearly shown here is that history is written by historians, and archaeology, at least in modern times, is a very young science. And it appears that archaeology has been written by archaeologists. And now you have great minds like Michael Cremo and now Robert Balval, who are publishing and literally shattering the marble foundations of modern archaeology and opening the minds of modern people that humans have probably been here on this planet for a long, long time.
Oh, yeah.
Millions
and
millions of years.
Yeah, I love Robert's work because what he's saying, and he's using, I mean, a really good logic, and it makes sense. And I mean, he's got it so well diagrammed out, you know, and so well documented that he is the more logical way to go. If you were to say it any other way, at least he makes sense. At least he has something to build on. And it lines up.
I mean,
everything lines up.
Yeah. Thank you for saying this.
Now, Robert, you're mentioning a conference that's coming up in Dubai. We have about 5 minutes, and I want you to announce the conference so that people know if they want to get to Dubai and attend this landmark conference, they can do so.
I really would like to do two things, because I'd like to draw attention. I mean, what we've been discussing here is nearly the beginning of a long adventure for those who would like to join in through conferences and through books that we're writing. Now, let me say that I'm at the moment I'm just launched my latest book in America. It's been published in Europe last year, called The Egypt Code. In the American version, I've been given the opportunity by the publishers to put two very large appendices that kind of set the scene, if you like, of what we've been talking in the last hour or so about this new discoveries in the Sahara. And I've asked Mahmoud Marai, the discoverer, to write an appendix for this book. So if you do get this book, it will not only provide you with the thesis that I've developed over years regarding the pharaohs, but now we're moving into their origin And the appendices in this book kind of gives you the beginning of this exploration. That's one. You can get more information about this through the website, and I'll give you my website in a minute. The other is that I, because of all these discoveries, I'm planning a new book with Thomas Brophy, as I was saying before, the astrophysicist, and probably get a lot of consultation from Michael Cremo and a variety of other researchers to expose this lost civilization, this lost culture of the Sahara, and to even open the way, as Robin was saying, it's Robin, is it? The lady who was looking.
Yes, that's correct.
That, yes, all this is fine, but there is a beyond this. Now, like I said, I'm taking it step by step. So we'll write this book, and we're calling it Black Genesis, because that's what it is. I mean, we're looking at the black genesis of our civilization, at least the civilization that sprung from the pharaonic civilization. And we're going to examine the artifacts, the alignments, the stone circuits that we found there, and provide a kind of basis, a kind of study that will then, hopefully, either if we do, we're still around to do it, but to tempt others to look beyond this, because, like I said, the evidence points that the astronomical evidence points that they're telling us that there is a much earlier phase to this. And we really have to find out. We have to go to the source. So step by step here. But the first shocker, if you like, is that, to me, it changes not just the dates and the knowledge that there was a sophisticated origin that we haven't yet properly understood, but that we have to come to terms that we are a universal culture. And that, I think this is wonderful, because what's happening in the United States now is something that, maybe perhaps you people don't realize it, but you've caused one hell of a shift here, around the world. I mean, I've traveled in the last 2 days from Europe to the Arabian Gulf, passing through Egypt. I just stopped in Egypt a few days ago, and I'm going back there. And there's a buzz going on. There's a buzz because suddenly, something happened in your country that has sent an amazing message through the election of Barack Obama, is that we really have to regard ourselves in a very different way now. And we have to shed all these blockages and biases and prejudices that we have, because we are emerging in a new way of looking at ourselves. And the book that we're going to present, this Black Genesis book, is kind of tying all this up. That we really have to stop thinking in limited terms. We have to regard ourselves as a common source, a common race, living in the same planet. This is the beauty of this kind of research, is that people often tell me, you're looking at ancient origins, but what does it have to do with our lives today? Well, it has a lot to do with our lives today, because we're rediscovering who we are. We're waking up from a long period of amnesia, where we're kind of slowly emerging in an awareness that we are all from the same source. And beyond, because the wonderful thing is that all this tying up with people who are astrophysicists who are coming into this research, people who are anthropologists with an open mind, architects, engineers, chemists, all these people are getting together and realizing that we now can kind of write a new vision, something that makes more sense to us, that brings us all together, and opens that window into really asking the big question, where do we come from? Really, where do we come from? But, having asked the question, we can now also start temptingly, and in a logical way. I like what Robin said. You know, we really have to stay reasonable and logical. We mustn't go wild, because that's where it gets spoiled. But we are courageous enough, because we've set the scene, to ask, where are we going? What's the mission here? What are we supposed to do? Well, the first thing is, let's find out where we came from, and then we progress. So this is what's happening. This is the exciting buzz that's going on. And in many ways, it is a signal that is affecting the whole world. I love it, because I'm walking now in the Middle East, with a completely different vision of how it was hardly a week ago. You know, there was a breakup of cultures, and now there's a kind of signal that's saying, no, we're all in the same boat here. We all have to figure it out, all of us together. This is what's happening. So I'd like to leave you with this message that we are starting to launch this idea from an archaeological, anthropological point of view, using the right resources. We're using people who can bring in their talent and their knowledge to explain this. People like Michael Cremo, who have looked at the vast order of artifacts that we have evidence all over the place. We're bringing astrophysics who can understand and explain to us these alignments that we're looking at and how sophisticated they are. We're bringing cultural anthropologists who are brave enough to explore the origins of our race and find these common denominators that are spread all over the world. This is what's happening. And I chose the Arabian Gulf because in many ways it's a wonderful place to be, because I'm in a cosmopolitan city here. I'm in a place where you walk in the street and you think you're on sort of planet cosmos. You know, there's Arabs in the street, there's Americans in the street, there's Europeans in the street, there's Indians, Indonesians. It's a wonderful place to start, you know, and this is, so we call this conference here, and we hope to bring this conference to the States and all over the place, all over Europe, to start spreading that message that we not only are from a common source, but we begin to understand it. We're beginning to know who we are. We're waking up from a long sleep. We're kind of getting a nice sugar dose here to wake up and see who we are. Are you still there, Brooks?
Yes, I'm still here, and I want to do what I can to help you promote a conference like that in the U.S. If someone wanted to attend your conference in Dubai, how would they do it?
Well, the easiest way is to go to my website, and I'll give you the website. It's www.robertbovall. Robert, everybody can spell. I'll give you my surname, B-A-U-V-A-L. B for Bobby, A for Apple, U for Uncle, V for Victor, A for Apple, L for London. It's one word, robertbovall@.co.uk. Do not go to .com because somebody has hijacked my old .com website and is telling all sorts of weird stuff. It's .co.uk. And there,
very
you
good.
Go to links, you'll find the conference advertised, and you'll find also, I'm organizing also for the more adventurous of the listeners to take people in the Sahara to actually look at this site, because this is what live archaeology is all about. You know, you
put me on the list.
Offering...
Put me on the list.
Hello?
Because I want to go out there. Robert, we're out of time. 3 hours
yes.
goes so fast on this program, you can't believe it. Your website's linked to ours. Your book is listed on our website, and we will continue to stay in touch.
Absolutely. Well, it was a delight talking to you, Brooke, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to spread the news.
Same here. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you later.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Well, there you have it, Earth Explorers. Oh, my gosh. We opened up a 20-hour program there, and we barely got out of there were 3 hours. We'll see you November 16th with another great program of X Squared Radio. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.